Okay, well, good morning. Let me first encourage people to move up to the seats that are still at the table. There's no reason to sit in the back. And let me welcome you all to the Center for Strategic and International Studies for today's panel on Ukraine's elections, where we'd like to talk about the process, the results, and then some of the implications for Ukrainian foreign and domestic policy. I'm Steve Pfeiffer. I'm a senior advisor here with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And I'm very pleased with the panel that we've been able to put together this morning to help us think through what's happened and what is likely to happen in the coming days, weeks, and months. And first, I'll introduce our panelists. On my left, Dr. Michael McFaul. Mike is a senior associate at Carnegie. He's also an associate professor of political science and the Peter and Helen Bing Research Fellow at Hoover Institution at Stanford. And he specializes in political and economic reform in post-communist countries. Mike's an extremely active author. Just 2 weeks ago, came out with a book which he co-edited with Anders Ausland, Revolution in Orange, which looks at the factors behind the Orange Revolution. And Mike holds a PhD from Oxford. Our second speaker will be Dr. Henry Hale. Henry is assistant professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, where he focuses on democracy and regime change in post-communist Eurasia. Previously, he was at Indiana University, and before that, he was at Harvard's Project on Strengthening Democratic Institutions. And Henry's first book, Why Not Parties in Russia, Democracy, Federalism, and the State, will come out later this year, and he holds a PhD from Harvard. And then our third panelist is Dr. Michael Hotzel. He is a senior foreign policy advisor and principal at DLA Piper Rudnick Gray Carey. And prior to joining that firm, he spent 11 years as the Democratic staff director on the Subcommittee for Europe of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he also served as the senior foreign policy advisor to Senator Joe Biden of Delaware. Mike has co-authored and edited 10 books, and he also holds a PhD from Harvard. My role will be to introduce the topic and then moderate. We'll try to keep our presentations relatively short to leave time for questions and discussion, and we'll keep this hopefully very informal. But I'll just begin by setting out the context with three observations about the elections. And the first one was on Sunday. I was actually watching the ballot from Berlin, where I was at a human rights conference. And you were able to follow it on CNN, BBC, and through the Internet from both Ukrainian and American sites. And the election struck me on Sunday as strikingly normal. Actually, it was a bit boring. But it was boring in a good sense in that the last exciting election, of course, was in 2004. But certainly the sorts of problems that one saw during my time in Kyiv and then when I was at the State Department in the elections in 1998, 1999, 2002, and then the first two rounds in 2004, where there were systemic abuses of administrative resources by the government, huge pressure on the press, you didn't see that this time. That's good news. Also on Monday, all credible monitoring groups termed the elections free, fair, and competitive. That's also good news. So I think this election does show that democracy is making progress within Ukraine. Democratic practices are taking hold. The second observation was late Sunday night, as you saw, the first wire service reports and then the first press stories on Monday, they seemed to focus on the fact that Yanukovych's Party of Regions had come in first, and they looked at the disappointing showing by Yushchenko's Our Ukraine, and they took these two factors and came up with the conclusion that the Orange Revolution is either dead, dying, or turning red. Those conclusions, I think, are premature, and I'll just cite two facts. It looks, as of this morning, that the Regions Party will come up with a little bit over 31% of the total vote, which is impressive compared to Our Ukraine or the Yulia Tymoshenko bloc. But bear in mind that in December of 2004, in the third round of the presidential elections, Yanukovych polled 44%. So there's a question here. Was this a huge surge to the Regions Party, or was this Yanukovych merely protecting his political base? The second factor is if you look at the Orange Revolution parties, the Tymoshenko bloc, Our Ukraine, and the Socialist Party of Ukraine, those three parties together came up with about 43% of the vote. And in Ukraine's election system, where parties that don't cross the 3% threshold are awarded no seats in the RADA, and then their votes are redistributed among those parties that do cross the threshold, that 42% to 43% of the vote is probably going to translate to somewhere between 55% and 57% of the seats in the RADA. So this may not be the huge defeat for the Orange Revolution that, you know, people were speculating about. The third observation is that you're now in a period of fairly intense negotiations in terms of building the coalition. And when you look at the electoral math, you have three large parties, Regions, the Tymoshenko Bloc, and our Ukraine. You can't put together a coalition that can command a majority that is more than 225 seats in the RADA without two of those three parties coming together. Tymoshenko and Yanukovych have been pretty clear that they're not prepared to work together, so that really boils down to two possibilities. The first possibility, and by far the most likely, is a restoration of the Orange Coalition, bringing together the Tymoshenko Bloc, our Ukraine, and the Socialist Party. And I noticed this morning that the Political Council of our Ukraine has, in fact, called for such a coalition, although I think this is going to be dependent on those discussions, or those very personal discussions, between Yushchenko and Tymoshenko. The second possibility is a coalition between Yanukovych's Regions Party and our Ukraine. That's less likely, but it's not to be excluded, particularly if Yushchenko and Tymoshenko are unable to patch over their differences. But the thing that strikes me is, although Yushchenko's party came in third and with disappointing numbers, the coalition really is his choice. He gets to choose between restoring the Orange Coalition or joining with the Regions Party. And, of course, that choice, I think, is going to have very different implications for Ukraine in terms of who will then be prime minister, and very different implications will flow from the choice with regards to the domestic and foreign policies that Ukraine will then pursue. So with that introduction, that context, I'd like to turn the talk first to Mike McQuall.
Thanks, Steve. When I was asked to join this panel and they said Ambassador Pfeiffer was going to chair it,
Dr. McCall,
said. I said, Steve, why do you need us? Why don't you just do it yourself? And after his introduction, I think we should just have questions and answers, because I think he's really summarized most certainly what I wanted to say. So let me just say it in brief form, adding a couple of caveats. And the context I want to start with is to remind you of the discussion about the Orange Revolution until just last week, both in this town and in Kiev, most certainly in Moscow, other European capitals, where the conventional wisdom was that the revolution had failed, the government was inept, Yulia Tymoshenko was a populist. My co-author here, co-editor here, is the champion of that particular line, Anders. Abysmal failure as a government. And Yushchenko, feckless leader, in unable to do the job of the presidency, and then tainted with corruption with the use Rus-Urk-Energo deal, right? I think there was some validity to those analyses, and most certainly the Ukrainians thought there was validity to those analyses. If you look at the, I think it was a Freedom House poll or one of the polls that came out about a month ago, and when Ukrainians were asked, is your country moving in the right direction, only 19% said yes and 60% said no. So that is the background for this election. And in normal elections, boring normal elections in boring democratic countries, what we know from social science, the retrospective theory of voting, it's called, is that people vote in their pocketbooks and they say, am I better off or worse off, as Ronald Reagan made so famous in his campaign. And if you're better off, you vote for the incumbents, and if you're worse off, you vote for the challengers. That's, I think, what was the background and what conventional wisdom was saying about this election. And as Steve has already pointed out, that didn't happen. And I think it's important to understand why it didn't happen and what's it mean for the future. For me, my bottom line is what it means for the future is that the democratic breakthrough that was the Orange Revolution, and that's the way I look at it, has not been reversed. that it is this election reaffirms the Democratic breakthrough course, but we're still in a polarized period in Ukrainian politics. And Ukraine will only become normal and boring where it doesn't mean any news, right? And when you hold a meeting like this, we want just three people to show up, not this many. That they haven't got there yet. They haven't got to a point where the elections are just boring and normal because the situation, politics in Ukraine are still polarized. So on the balance, I think it's an incredibly good outcome and incredibly positive with this one caveat about how to get beyond polarized politics. So with that background in mind, just five or six quick points. First, again, looking backwards rather than forwards, my view of the politics leading up to the Orange Revolution was it was an expression of democratic politics, not just government failure. The reason that you had debates about whether it was right to privatize or renationalize firms or not was because you had a pluralistic political system with an independent press. Those debates don't take place in regimes farther east of Ukraine. Moreover, Tymoshenko was fired when she was fired. By the way, that's what democratic governments do. If the government is not performing in parliamentary presidential systems, the prime minister gets fired. And if you look at opinion polls, the majority supported Yushchenko's decision at that time. I personally did not. I think it was a big mistake. But I'm not a Ukrainian voter, and I'm not the president of Ukraine. That's the way they get decided, and that was, I think, democratic politics at work. Moreover, the real miracle of this period is that Tymoshenko didn't have to go move to Belarus or Brussels. She wasn't put in jail. She wasn't denied registration to compete. She got to go back to the electorate and say, this is why, you know, this is what I believe, and this is why I think these folks were wrong to have fired me. That is, she got to respond in the public, and that, I think, is democracy in action. Second, Ukrainians, as I've just quoted from those numbers, obviously disappointed with the results of the revolution. And by the way, all people living in post-revolutionary situations are disappointed with the results of the revolution. I don't know one where they've been satisfied. Expectations are always grossly exaggerated. But they didn't respond by checking out of politics. That, I think, is what's quite striking, again, about this situation. Other countries in post-revolutionary situations expressed their dissatisfaction by not showing up at the polls. Ukrainians did. Whether it was 60 or 70%, we're still not quite sure. I think the official result now is 59%, although the CEC announced yesterday it was 70%. But either one of those numbers, I think, is a positive. Third, regarding the process, as Steve's already said, freer and fairer than the last election. Now, I think if we look a little more closely, and this, I think, is a bit of a criticism of our electoral monitors, there were some real problems in this election. Out in the in the eastern part of the country, it was very difficult for people who were not part of the Yanukovych bloc or affiliated with them to campaign. It was hard for them to get on the press. The press there was slanted. But that didn't come up in the reports. Likewise, when I was in Ukraine 3-4 weeks ago talking to Tymoshenko and Mr. Moroz, they complained quite vehemently at the time about state administrative resources being used on behalf of our Ukraine in a very similar way that they complained about Kuchma and Yanukovych year and a half ago. But it's always compared to what? I think it's fair to say this is probably the freest and fairest election you've seen there, at least in the last decade. Fourth, despite all the alleged failures of Tymoshenko, Yushchenko, and the Orange Coalition, Steve has already pointed out that in the aggregate, the vote is almost identical to the third round of the presidential vote, almost identical in the aggregate. Now, there's a problem in assuming that the aggregate in this vote and the aggregate in the last vote means that people are voting the same. This is called the ecological fallacy in political science. There could be, it's a possibility, and you can only check this with survey data, it could be that there were lots of shifts that in the aggregate produced the same result. I'm skeptical that that's the case here, but let's be clear that this is a problem. It's an assumption of punditry. It's not a finding of social science. But in the aggregate, very striking how stable electoral preferences were, not how much volatility there were. Steve's already quoted the numbers, 35, 37, depending on how you put together the blue coalition, 42, 44, depending on how you add up the orange coalition. That's almost exactly the same roughly percentage points that you had in the third round of 2004. And moreover, Yanukovych being the big victor, I mean, he's down 12 percentage points from where he was back then. Now, that's the result of a parliamentary election, a multi-party parliamentary election versus a presidential election. Presidential elections, by definition, by structure, in the runoff are polarizing events where it forces, obviously, voters to choose one or the other. So this is to be expected, but there hasn't been a lot of movement in terms of these two big blocks. The movement is within the block, and the movement is within the orange coalition block. That is, you know, the real winner, the real surprise victory, comeback kid in this election is Yulia Tymoshenko, who, after all, just a couple months ago was 10 points below what we think are now going to be the official results. That, I think, is the real story. That should have been page one headline news from our reporters. And, you know, explaining that, understanding that, you know, I have my theories about it, which we'll go into in questions. But that, I think, is the real surprising outcome here, not in the aggregate. A couple of other smaller points in terms of the outcome that I think you see from this. First, thank God for 3% barriers. You know, the Vitrenko got like 0.2 percentage points below 3%, and so that's good, in my opinion. Another lesson of this election, student groups that try to become electoral parties fail. Otpor was a disaster when they became a political party in Serbia in 2000. Para, the same result. And I think this is really tragic because there's a lot of very good MPs that decided to join up with that coalition who will not be in the parliament. So, you know, a lesson to be learned for those of you who work with student groups in post-communist Europe or anywhere else. Stay to what you're good at, which is, you know, pressing from civil society. Don't become political parties. Yet again, that has been proven here. And the other smaller point to emphasize is the centrist gambit, right? The notion that we need new leaders, that the orange folks are bad and the blue folks are bad. I'm Mr. Litvin, and I'm going to come in, and I'm going to save the day. Lots of chatter about that 6 months ago in Ukraine, and even a couple months ago. You know, the bankers all love this, right? We need a centrist. Centrists are good. Mr. Litvin, he's going to really deliver, and look at his numbers up there in Chernihiv. Turned out not such a great showing. There's no room yet for a centrist alternative. And that gets me to my fifth and penultimate point about the polarized electorate. On the one hand, this is good because it brings out the orange coalition and it shows that the revolution's not dead. On the other hand, it's bad because it means that this election was not about pocketbook issues. It was not about economic debates. It was not about are you a social democrat or a liberal or a communist. It wasn't about those kinds of things that in the long run I think are necessary to get beyond the linguistic geographic divide that drives voter preferences. You want parties to be able to appeal across the nation on socioeconomic issues. And so far in Ukraine, that's proving to be very difficult. And in the long run, that's bad, not only because it means that elections are about, you know, non-platform, non-issue things, and I think this election was similar in that regard, but it also means it's going to be very difficult to put together stable coalition governments. Yes, I think Steve's outlined the two scenarios, right? The orange or with Mr. Yanukovych, and it looks, in my opinion, positively, we're finally moving to the recreation of the orange coalition. Whether Yulia has to be prime minister or not is another question. We can get to that later. I think she would be a brilliant speaker, and that would place her well to be the next president of Ukraine. But put another technocrat prime minister. That's my personal opinion. But the point is, even that is going to be, you know, 55%, as you said, in the best scenario. And if you look at who is on these lists, you know, a lot of a lot of people who aren't loyal to the cause. It could be, I see the possibility that if politics continue to be polarized, that you could have a cycle of unstable government in Ukraine. Sometimes that's not so bad. Poland's a great example. You know, you can have governments every 6 months and you know, things march on in a positive way. So it doesn't necessarily drive policy in a bad way. But other countries we can talk about and remember that does drive things in a bad way. And on that, I think I'll end. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. I thought, even after my introduction, you might have one or two things to add to the discussion. Next, Henry.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll talk a bit about the campaign itself and kind of how we got to a lot of these results. I think picking up on some of the themes that have already been stressed. I think just in general, three kind of overarching themes that I'll stress will be, first of all, the significant change in Ukraine's political landscape with regard to political parties, especially compared to 2002, but also, interestingly enough, compared to the 2004 presidential elections, but again, I think in a way that Mike has already alluded to. Secondly, an interesting phenomenon whereby you've seen a great disillusionment in the Yushchenko presidency, combined with a stable support, a stable continuation of support for the ideals, I would say, of the Orange Revolution, and therefore ultimately some sort of stability in terms of general support for an orange policy and what you might call an anti-orange set of outcomes. And third, I would also stress the importance as a backdrop to all this of the constitutional reforms that took place in December of 2004 and were finally implemented in January of this year, which provides some of the backdrop, meaning a shift in power from the presidency to the parliament, which I think has helped create some of the intensity of this political battle. So what I'll do is just break the discussion down into the two major camps, if you will, the kind of orange camp and then what might be called the anti-orange camp. So first of all, of course, I think we have to take a look at Yushchenko. And it seems pretty clear from all the numbers that he and his team have experienced a major collapse in support since the Orange Revolution, which helped fuel his party's disappointing showing. So if we take a look at the votes in comparison with previous elections, in 2002, the Our Ukraine bloc that he headed came in first and got 24% of the vote. And, of course, that was followed later by the 2004 elections, where he ultimately got over 50% in the final round of the presidential voting. And so to go back down to 14% or so for his vote is a significant drop, even from 2002, when you had Kuchma in power. And I think one of the problems has been a significant disillusionment of voters and general supporters of the Orange Revolution, which is probably evident to most people who've traveled in Ukraine recently. And this comes down to a lot of factors which are fairly well known. First of all, a lack of visible economic progress. Official figures, again, depending on exactly how you calculate them, record for example, economic growth in 2004 of about 12%, 2005 down to 4%. By some projections, it's even going to be lower in 2006. And so, you know, there's in terms of statistics, there's something for some of these voters to have been disappointed about, especially because they expected an economic upturn. This is also reflected in opinion polls. There was a recent survey that was sponsored by IFAS and the Democratic Initiatives Foundation in Ukraine. They issued a report recently which came, of a poll which was taken in November 2005, that is just before the campaign really got underway. And when people were asked about the economic situation in the country, 57% thought that it had become worse since the Orange Revolution. Only 13% thought that it had gotten better. And 26% thought that the economy had not changed. And then if people were asked about their own family's economic situation in the past year, 42% thought that their own family situation had gotten worse. 14% thought it had gotten better. And this is a very interesting contrast with what happened in October, what had happened, what the results were the previous year. So a poll taken in October 2004 asked the same question, has your family's economic situation gotten better in the past year? 26%, as opposed to the 14%, now thought that at that time thought that their situation had improved. And 27%, again, a reduction in number, thought that the their family situation had actually gotten worse. So it's interesting that all of this has taken place within the context of a general perception of an economic decline, and that certainly reflected itself in the course of the campaign. In addition, there's a perception that corruption continues unabated in Ukraine. Now, here again, there's no great way to measure it accurately. Transparency International in 2005 reported a slight decline in corruption since the Orange Revolution. But the score in Ukraine for 2005 was still greater than Russia's score. It was still worse than Russia's score had been in 2004. Russia's kind of moving in the other direction. So there seems to have been, according to the objective indicator, at least some decline, but not a significant decline. Average Ukrainian voters, in many cases, would see that a lot of big business figures still remain tightly associated with the Ukrainian government. Major figures who had been accused of egregious crimes, such as former President Kuchma, had not been prosecuted, or at least significantly brought to justice in the case of some others. And so the same poll that I talked about earlier by IFAS and the Democratic Initiatives Foundation asked people whether they thought they had seen improvement in the battle against corruption since the Orange Revolution that took place at the end of 2004. And there, 21% saw improvement, but 40% thought that there was no change, and 29% thought that things were actually worse than before. So the clear majority did not see any particular improvement or thought things were getting worse. And I think this was exacerbated, this sort of view, by impressions that were created by the fact that certain compromises were reached with the opposition. There is the infamous deal between Yanukovych and Yushchenko that took place to get Prime Minister Yakhanurov approved in September of last year. And interestingly enough, where people do seem to see some positive change, I think, is in the area of democracy. But it doesn't seem like Yushchenko actually got a whole lot of credit for it. And that is the general perception of whether or not democracy has been improved in Ukraine has actually gone up only slightly, according to this poll. Basically people thinking Ukraine was a democracy went up from 23% in 2004 only to 26% in November of 2005. Now, partly this is because people associate a lot of things with democracy, including the security of jobs and payment of pensions, things that we don't typically associate in that definition. But even when people were asked about whether voting gives ordinary people influence, only 37% agreed in November 2005. And that was a decline from 53% in February of 2005. So that is, there was an increase in kind of efficacy, you could call it, on the part of the people in the meaning of their faith and the meaning of their vote right after the Orange Revolution, but that also seems to have declined along with all these other things. So I think an important backdrop here is just to stress the great disillusionment that I think seems to have taken place, particularly with the Yushchenko presidency. And so people don't see a major change for the better. And one can debate whether or not they should have, in fact, expected such a major change that should have taken place so immediately. But the fact remains, a lot of people expected that the Orange Revolution would lead to a dramatic change in the way the whole system worked, the relationship between the state and the economy, levels of corruption, a whole set of things. And because that hasn't happened, I think a lot of people have become quite disappointed. And the infighting amongst the former partners in the Orange Revolution, particularly Timoshenko and Yushchenko, has not helped much because you had these accusations of corruption being lobbed back and forth. So in the face of this, how did the Yushchenko team campaign? Well, I think, again, it's a complicated campaign, and they actually ran lots of ads on all kinds of different themes. But certain common themes jumped out at me just looking at a lot of television there, among other things, and looking at the flyers. There was lots of orange symbolism. So, that was cool. Just the color itself was used in almost all the ads. Crowds were showed on the Maidan, the public square, and just that kind of victorious image, I think, was cultivated by the campaign strategists. The television ads, in terms of substance, tended to stress, I guess, what I might call, for want of a better word, modernization. That is, Ukraine's becoming a civilized European country. And I think they rightly thought that that was what a lot of people wanted in Ukraine. And they tried to play up their party's, the Our Ukraine bloc's association with that. So things like a modern military, an end to corruption, basically becoming kind of a normal society. But this was not a campaign that Ukraine should become basically a vassal of the West. So there was one ad in particular that stressed that Ukraine's troops would not serve, for example, in Iraq, and Ukraine's troops should be serving at home. So it wasn't a wholeheartedly pro-Western, or at least pro-American campaign. Other themes that were stressed had to do with freedom. Yushchenko as a leader, I think, was promoted quite strongly. One ad featured a young woman saying that she disliked Yushchenko personally and thought he was a good leader. And they did try to emphasize the economic changes and to put a positive spin on them. But I think part of the problem was, of course, that all this proved to be a fairly hard sell. And in fact, a lot of the polls running up to the orange election showed that a lot of the undecided voters, a larger share than normal, were people who had supported Yushchenko during the previous presidential elections. So I think that helps us understand why kind of the late surge in voting relative to previous polls, things broke towards Tymoshenko. And as a result, Yushchenko got his result only about 14% of the vote and came in first in only three western regions of Ukraine, Lviv, Ivano-Frankivsk, and Zakarpatska Oblast, at least according to the preliminary returns with about 95% of the precincts reporting. So what about the Tymoshenko bloc? And I agree with Mike. It's important to stress Tymoshenko, I think, in a lot of ways is the real winner here, especially if you take a look at where she was in 2002, where her bloc got 7% of the vote. Now she's up to roughly 22% of the vote and I think has wound up in a very advantageous position. And here I would stress several notable features of her campaign that I think helped put her in this position. She sought to blend two different kind of appeals in a way that seems actually to have worked out, and that is both rejecting the orange symbolism that characterized the Our Ukraine campaign and a lot of the other campaigns of more minor figures who had supported the Orange Revolution but campaigned on their own, the bloc of Kostenko and Pliush or Pará. The youth group, for example. The idea behind rejecting the use of orange was to essentially broaden her appeal, because the color orange in a lot of ways was associated with kind of what a lot of people in the East and South saw as a polarized regional a strategy and orientation. And so by rejecting those colors, she was attempting to broaden her appeal in the other areas, particularly the south and east of Ukraine, and also to distance herself, I think, to set herself apart from the disillusioned orange supporters. And therefore, her chief symbol, which was emblazoned almost everywhere, was a little stylized red heart, kind of stylized almost like a little check as if in a ballot, as if on a ballot for her party. She frequently appeared kind of cupping this heart lovingly. And, she was always dressed in white against a white background. And so really it was kind of black, white with this red heart symbolism. And her slogan, in very close association with the heart imagery, was there is justice and it is worth fighting for. And so she was really kind of trying to capitalize on this idea that she was the heart of the revolution, that really wanted to take things further than Yushchenko was willing to go, not make the compromises that Yushchenko had made. And this framed her consistent effort to appear more radical and more committed to kind of this broader concept of justice than Yushchenko was. So advocating greater, more extensive reprivatization, punishing corrupt oligarchs and politicians, rejecting any sort of deal with the Orange Revolution losers, the Yanukovych camp, stridently opposing Yushchenko's compromise on the gas deal with Russia, for example. She also stressed a theme of hope. The idea that spring will prevail. So I brought back a poster here so you can kind of get a sense of her kind of dressed in white and this sort of hopeful image for the future of the plant sprouting. And you can see the little heart down here. Unfortunately, I didn't have one with a big heart, but this was what was in all of her ads for the most part and flyers. And here's just as a sample of kind of a flyer that was sent around by the Yushchenko, our Ukraine camp. You can see just full of orange, you know, the images of the Maidan. And so it was quite striking to me that, that Tymoshenko really moved quite far away from that in terms of the imagery that she was trying to propagate. And so interestingly enough, I think, a lot of the most heated campaign activity took place not so much in the south or the east, not so much even in Kiev, although some places there, but in a lot of the western oblasts, which had been orange-oriented, but where you had a lot of people disillusioned with Yushchenko. You saw a very heated battle between Tymoshenko and Yushchenko, the Our Ukraine and Tymoshenko blocs, as well as some of the other parties like Para. So, you know, when I was in Lviv, I initially actually went to Lviv and thought, wow, what a lively campaign. And then I showed up in Kiev, and it was a lot more sedate. And I think from what I've heard in the south and eastern regions, it was even kind of more sedate because things had more or less been determined how things would go there. I would just also think, I mean, a couple other things that she stressed that I think worked for her, Tymoshenko, you know, was, of course, her personality, as you can see from just how visible she was in her posters. I mean, a lot of the way her block's name was listed, it was often listed as the block of Yulia and then Tymoshenko in actually kind of small letters, so kind of a very personalized campaign. And interestingly enough, she was very explicitly campaigning for prime minister. There were some posters that I saw, billboards around, for example, in Lviv, that didn't even mention the Rada elections and said that basically people were voting for the next prime minister. And so this level of personalization and campaigning for power was important, and especially in light of the constitutional reform, which transfers some power from the presidency to the parliament, which then gets to basically select the prime minister. Her campaign was all about how the prime minister, in fact, will hold all the power. Yushchenko disagrees, so I do agree. I think we're going to see a period of struggle, no matter who is prime minister, over exactly how the powers are divided and made up. So Tymoshenko, I think, winds up in a very strong position, because either she becomes basically the leader of an orange coalition in the parliament, or if you get a coalition between Yanukovych and Yushchenko, she becomes the prime opposition. And that's probably a position that she is not going to be uncomfortable in. And so I think her future is probably bright in any case, no matter how things go, at least in the shorter to medium term. So Socialist Party, I won't dwell on their performance. I mean, basically, it was almost the same as what happened in 2002, 6% in 2006, slightly down from 7% in 2002. I mean, they tended to stress the ministers that they had in the government. That didn't seem to add them an extra boost of authority. So finally, to talk a little bit about the anti-orange camp, and I call it anti-orange because you have both the blue imagery of Yanukovych with the red of the communists. Overall, they performed more strongly than they did, interestingly enough, than 2002 when Kuchma was in power. The United Ukraine bloc, which is the pro-Kuchma bloc, got about 12% of the vote, whereas 2006 got 32%, the Party of Regions anyway. And so the Party of Regions stressed a few different campaign themes, and one of the primary themes, of course, was a negative campaign against the government led by, or the, you know, the government it kind of in a vague sense, but more directed, I think, at Yushchenko's presidency and the way he has run things overall. So it stressed the decreasing economic growth, the kind of figures I talked about, the ads decried rising prices of basic goods. They'd show, you know, potatoes and then a very menacing bar graph that showed a huge, you know, kind of increase in prices and declines in production. Warned of heating costs going up after the elections. Branded the government's under Yushchenko, incompetent, and the government basically warned that the government has lost control, and then stressed Yanukovych as an alternative that could present strong government to Ukraine, promising higher pensions, paying stipends and pensions and wages on time, and characterized them as tried and true methods, referring back to the economic improvement that a number of people appear to have experienced prior to that. They did play some on the issue of Russia and the Russian language, that is, for stronger ties with Russia, but not capitulation. And some ads were done in Russian. They'd have kind of average people speaking Russian, which kind of stood out in the Ukrainian campaign. But I would say that other parties stressed these nationalist issues, or kind of anti-nationalist, if you will, more strongly. So the Vitrenko bloc, of course, was constantly, you know, demonstrating in Kiev or on television about the Moldova issue or campaigning against NATO. The bloc that was led by former President Kravchuk and Viktor Medvedchuk, former Kuchma chief of staff, had a very sharply defined campaign against NATO, for the Commonwealth of Independent States, single economic space, for Russia as a state language, but this didn't seem to work for them. So those issues didn't quite have the pull that they had hoped that they would. So in the end, I think it's interesting just to think about some of the regional breakdowns of these votes, because Yushchenko, it turns out, came into first place in only three western districts. The Party of Regions came in first place in 10 out of the 27 Ukrainian regions, again, almost all in the south and east, again, depending on how you define it. But I think one of the most interesting things is that Tymoshenko came out in first place in 14, according to these preliminary results, of the 27 regions. And interestingly enough, she came lower than second place in only three of the regions. And so she actually did fairly well in a lot of the eastern and southern regions as well. And so, interestingly enough, she has managed to at least get some modicum of support that is stretched across Ukraine, more so than I think than either the Party of Regions or Our Ukraine was able to do. So in that, there may be some hope that there, you know, like Tymoshenko or Hayder, you know, there does seem to be some kind of, you know, it seems that some politicians are able to find some kind of support in a variety of different Ukrainian regions. But of course, the polarization, I would say, still on the whole continues. The Party of Regions, for example, got 36% of its vote from just two regions, Donetsk and Luhansk. So just the final thing that I'll stress is that the Party of Regions also has really squeezed out the Communist Party in the south and the east, which was very interesting. The Communist Party got 20% in 2002 and only 4% in this election. And almost all those votes seem to have gone to Party of Regions, largely, I think, because they saw that as the most effective opposition to the Orange parties. So basically, I guess, I mean, I'll leave other topics for question and answer, and look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Henry. Okay, I think we've actually had a very good look now at what has happened up to this point. And what I suggested to Mike Hotzel that he discuss is looking at some of the implications of the two possible coalitions that may emerge.
Thank you, Steve. I'm going to look at the implications largely from an international perspective. I think it's interesting. I was talking before the panel started with Henry that I certainly agree with Steve that the election was strikingly normal and maybe boring, and that's not a bad thing. But I think when one gets to the realm of likely policy ramifications, particularly in the international arena, then I think things get a little bit less sure. I must say, I myself can't remember when I've had to make prognoses with which I'm less completely comfortable than I am with regard to Ukraine and its international posture in the future. Certainly, contrary to the headlines in the popular press, which my colleagues have described, that the sky is falling and Ukraine's going back to Moscow and all that, official Washington has reacted, I think, in a very mature, calm, and I would say even confident way. The Bush administration is very confident that it will be able to work with whichever coalition emerges. One official said to me, there's no panacea, there's no perfect outcome in Ukraine. Certainly a new reconstituted orange coalition is preferable in principle, but we could live with the other side, and I'll talk about that later. Despite the irregularities that Mike McFaul mentioned, and he went on to say that it was the freest and fairest election in Ukraine. I think that's after the 2004 experience. That's a big deal, and it's an especially big deal in Europe. And obviously, the hard part now comes. We think that in Washington, as I said, that a reconstituted orange coalition would be best for the people of Ukraine. It would continue, in general, keeping the country on a path toward Euro-Atlantic institutions. It would have its own challenges, and again, my colleagues have admirably described most of those. In the realm of foreign policy, I'd like to begin with NATO, which is obviously the institution with which the United States has the most interaction with Ukraine. Question number one, I think, would clearly be, would a reconstituted orange coalition get a NATO membership action plan, or MAP, as it's known in the terminology? Well, first of all, I could say the fact that it was essentially a free and fair election is terribly important, because had there been a repeat of 2004, the answer to a MAP would have been a resounding no. So that hurdle is clearly cleared. And I think the fact that almost everybody would recognize, while there may be some hesitation in Brussels, in NATO Brussels, about further enlargement, there's nowhere near the enlargement fatigue, I would submit, that there is in the EU. Timoshenko, as far as I know, really doesn't seem to have a firm policy on NATO. Maybe I'll be corrected by others here. Even if she does, I don't think that she would spend much of her political capital on this issue. Moroz, who would obviously have to be part of the coalition if it were to be an orange coalition, is ambivalent at best. When pressed, he's always more negative. But again, I don't think that this is the key priority for the socialists. So my guess is that a reconstituted orange coalition would probably request a MAP, membership action plan, from NATO. And I'm confident that if that happened, the United States would then try to get Ukraine an invitation to a MAP in this calendar year of 2006. We shouldn't forget, of course, that although the criteria for admission to the EU are incomparably more complex and demanding than those for admission to NATO, the MAP itself is also an excellent mechanism to help effect political, economic, and social reforms, as the experience of the last two rounds of NATO enlargement has shown. So, again, if we're making these assumptions, orange coalition, desire to apply for a MAP, U.S. would agree. Let's look for a second at what the likelihood for eventual fairly rapid admission of Ukraine would be. Well, I think there's several plus factors, and there are one certainly negative ones. First of all, in the plus category, NATO already has an intensified dialogue with Ukraine. After the 2004 Istanbul summit, we embarked upon something called a NATO-Ukraine action plan, which is sort of a mini map. So institutionally, it would not be a huge leap to a real MAP. Secondly, and maybe more importantly, Ukraine's performance so far on this NATO-Ukraine action plan has been quite good, especially in the area of military reform. It has a Ministry of Defense that seems really committed to change. Defense Minister Rutsenko is a former colonel who once quit in protest against the mess, and then came back, and he is kind of a golden boy in NATO for a very articulate, very well-informed man. Also, Rutsenko has sent a regular stream of officers, Ukrainian officers to the Marshall Center in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, and also to staff colleges here in the United States. And then he's placed them in responsible positions when they return to Ukraine. The third plus factor, I would say, is the performance of the recent performance of Ukrainian troops in PKOs, peacekeeping operations. It's really improved dramatically since their scandalous performance in S4 in Bosnia. The less said about that, the better. For example, Ukrainian troops are serving well in K4 in Kosovo, serving under the Poles in the U.S. sector in the south of the province. Realizing that one of the reasons for the appalling corruption in the S4 case was the lamentable equipment that the Ukrainian troops were provided, Defense Minister Rutsenko has made sure that now when Ukrainian troops are deployed, they go well-equipped, well-supplied. One negative factor in Ukraine's potential candidacy for NATO stands out, and that is in the area of public opinion, a matter which is very important to the United States and also to its NATO European allies. Currently, the most recent figures I've seen show only about a 30% support in the country for NATO membership and really low, abysmally low support in the East. What is needed if Ukraine is going to be a candidate, is going to get a map, is a public relations campaign so that the people, the populace, get to understand NATO. There's obviously in the former Warsaw Pact area, there clearly was just, decades of propaganda, one-sided propaganda, with whatever flaws NATO may or may not have, the caricature was a grotesque one. And to put this into perspective, exactly the same challenge initially faced two of the three countries in the 1999 round of enlargement, namely the Czech Republic and Hungary. I mean, I must say, I played a bit of a role in these things in the Senate and the confirmation. And I mean, I remember talking to Václav Havel, Senator Biden, and I were talking to him in Hrodzsany, and he just was shaking his head and saying, you know, our people are clueless. We have to make clear to them what's going on. And they did. And the same thing happened in Hungary. And then more recently, in the 2004 round of enlargement, Slovenia and Slovakia both had real problems with their publics to begin with. Slovenia's was cured in a rather horrible way almost overnight 3 years ago this month with Zoran Djindjic's assassination in Serbia. Overnight, the Slovene public realized they were still living in a dangerous neighborhood, and support went from the low 40s to 66% or something like that in less than a week. Anyway, the Ukrainian government knows, at least the ones that want to get into NATO, that this is a problem, and I think that if an orange coalition is formed, that they will address it. Now, what's the other side of the equation? How would NATO allies react to a U.S.-sponsored initiative to get a map for Ukraine by the end of the year? Bottom line, again, this is, to put it mildly, my presentation is speculation after speculation. My guess is that it would not be a slam dunk. It'd be a challenge to get it through NATO. I think ultimately it would succeed. The new allies in NATO, especially Poland and Lithuania, but also Slovakia, Latvia, and Estonia, and maybe a few others, would be very supportive. Some of our older NATO allies, however, are quite skeptical. First of all, they view a map, a membership action plan, as a statement that eventually a country will get into the alliance. So far they have. But I think fundamentally, some of these Western European allies are more worried about EU enlargement with NATO than with NATO enlargement. And so far, every country that has gotten into NATO has either gotten into the EU or, in the case of Bulgaria and Romania, are about to get into the EU. So therefore, I think some of the debates, and they have not become tremendously public and frequent yet, but some of the debates in Europe, I think, are more hostility to further EU enlargement, sort of hiding behind a NATO enlargement cover. To be more specific, at least, again, this is commonly held opinions, at least in the Pentagon and just across the river. I think France would be against. Now, even within France, there's anything but unanimity. I guess there's never unanimity in France on anything, which is a good thing for France, too. But an interesting personal exception is Pierre Lelouch, who's the president of the NATO Parliamentary Assembly. And just 2 days ago in Kiev, he made a statement that several of you probably saw, that Ukraine, and I quote, deserves better than being abandoned on Russia's doorstep, close quote. He clearly is in favor of it. There's some feeling that Germany might be lukewarm on membership for Ukraine in NATO, at least initially, perhaps because of the EU enlargement lurking in the background, but also perhaps because of a fear about the ramifications on the relationship with Russia. When all is said and done, though, the United States is still a big dog in NATO, and I think the chances are better than 50-50 that we could get a map for an orange coalition Ukraine by the end of this year. Other issues for Washington. Well, I can't imagine that, the Bush administration would ask for more foreign assistance to Ukraine. In FY05, the Freedom Support Act gave $78.6 million to Ukraine. For this fiscal year, it will probably be closer to $83 million. And the administration emphasizes, and they're correct, that there have been two very significant achievements earlier this month, very high-profile achievements in the U.S.-Ukraine relationship. Number one, the bilateral agreement establishing the terms of trade between our two countries, which is an essential bilateral preparation for WTO accession for Ukraine. And secondly, of course, the lifting earlier this month of Jackson-Vanik. For its own good, Ukraine has to make a lot of these reforms anyway. We'll probably talk about that during the Q&A session. I think its economic situation, including getting rid of corruption or minimizing it, is priority number one. And I'm going to skip over that part because we clearly don't have the time. Washington, I think, has many concerns about, when I say Washington, official Washington, has many concerns about Tymoshenko. Seeming unpredictability, interest in reprivatizing. She, I would say, has done some valuable work in getting the scrutiny of the energy of the gas deal out into the public. But even that, given her own professional background, one isn't quite sure where that's going to go. I will say that there have been. She has had meetings with several senior people in the European Bureau, the State Department, and I think on a personal level, and there are people here who know her personally, I don't, I think that relations look fairly good. It's interesting, I mean, everyone says she doesn't appear to be a viscerally anti-American type. What I found even more interesting, though, is a senior State Department official quickly added to me, I wouldn't call Yanukovych viscerally anti-American either. Looking at the European Union, I think, like the United States, the EU clearly would prefer a reconstituted orange coalition to a blue-orange one. Everyone to the west of Ukraine seems to be satisfied with the running of the election. Ukraine is already a partner of the EU under the West Europe Initiative, a special neighborhood policy with funding from the EU, and as such, it has had its own action plan. There are certain buzzwords in international statecraft, action plan, stability pact. They basically cover everything. Anyway, the EU does have an action plan with Ukraine. The next stage would be negotiations for a free trade agreement. And even this is already almost in the works. It's called for in the action plan with the EU. Like the United States, the EU has given Ukraine the status of a free market economy, a precondition for a free trade agreement. Brussels, like Washington, however, realizes that these kind of trade agreements with Tymoshenko as a leading person in the coalition would not be easy. Ukraine would have to satisfy some market access conditions, which might be difficult for her to accept. Finally, as I stated above, there is really no doubt whatsoever about a widespread antipathy within the EU in the wake of the referenda in France and the Netherlands last year to EU enlargement. Very quickly, let me look at the less likely scenario number two, a blue-orange. It almost sounds like the Washington Metro, a blue-orange Yanukovych-Yushchenko coalition. There is brave talk here in Washington that we could work with a blue-orange coalition also, and certainly we try to make the best of it. If this would happen, I think the Bush administration would attempt to work with Yanukovych to deepen reform, with a long-term view being that reform ipso facto would lead Ukraine more in the direction of the Euro-Atlantic community, even if it would not be stated as an immediate goal for obvious political reasons. This may be wishful thinking. I don't think it is. In any case, the pace of reform, my guess, would be a lot slower than it would be in a new orange coalition. We might want to talk about that. On the surface, it would seem clear and logical that a blue-orange coalition would not ask NATO for a map. Official Yanukovych spokesmen within the past week have essentially said as much. Nonetheless, I'd be very surprised if the blue team, as it's sometimes called, would completely close the door to reform or to closer ties with the West. Certainly, I don't think you get anything approaching a Medvedchuk line in this regard. I was really surprised to learn that some senior people in Yanukovych's camp have said privately to some of our people that ultimately they wouldn't even close the door to NATO. My guess is that this is certainly, if it's true, a minority position within the party of the regions. I think maybe an explanation for this would be to utilize this as kind of a lever against Russia, in a sense almost like returning to a Kuchma-like policy, which certainly had its problems. Unless a blue-orange coalition, however, asked to withdraw from the NATO-Ukraine action plan, it would continue. As I said, we have one now. It's working, and it's working well. And as far as I know, Yanukovych has said nothing to indicate that if in power, he would pull out of this action plan. It would continue, maybe without NATO membership as a goal, working on things like interoperability, continued cooperation in partnership for peace exercises, and various other NATO operations. And for example, it is true that Ukraine's pulled out most of its has pulled out its combat troops from Iraq. Nonetheless, it still has a dozen trainers participating in the NATO training mission in Iraq. We know that under the Constitution, Yushchenko would still get to name the foreign and defense ministers, and he'd probably stick with Tarasyuk and Rydzenko. Lord knows what would happen in a blue-orange coalition. I'm really not sure what kind of deals would be made behind the scenes. My guess is that Tarasyuk would be the larger target of a blue team, of a government led by the blue team. Finally, myself, trying always to be optimistic, I would take a longer-term view and say that if there would be a blue-orange coalition with the changes that I just speculated with regard to NATO, and if the next election, as has happened in almost every case in Eastern Europe, Slovakia being the only exception I know of, the kind of a pendulum back and forth, you make reforms, you become unpopular, so your opponents come back in. If that would happen, and a orange coalition number two would come in the next election, if in fact this would happen after Ukraine had continued its participation in the NATO-Ukraine action plan, that would make the country that much stronger a candidate for membership. With regard to the European Union and its views on a blue-orange coalition, I think it's more or less on the same page as the United States. They prefer a reconstituted orange coalition. Being completely cynical, however, if a blue-orange coalition did emerge, it would make it easier for those within the EU who are against EU enlargement anyway to say, good Lord, we certainly couldn't have these folks. Actually, in the very short term, what I've been able to pick up in the last few days, Brussels is much more concerned about a prolonged stalemate in Kyiv than anything else. The campaign advertisements, as Henry has talked about them in great detail, but as far as I understand, the campaign advertisements of the Party of Regions made a clear distinction between membership in NATO and the EU. My guess is, and this is, again, speculation, that a blue-orange coalition would proceed very, very cautiously, but nonetheless in the general direction of reform, which certainly not a full speed ahead, but which would certainly not alienated from Europe, but it would just be a slower process getting closer. The biggest question mark I would have would be Russia and the gas deal. And here I have to say I am as confused as the next person. Of the three leading political figures it's Yushchenko who is the strongest defender of the gas deal. Not surprisingly, one generally defends something you hash out yourself. And Tymoshenko, of course, made her opposition to the gas deal the cornerstone of her campaign, and it was through her efforts that the January 4th protocol was made public. Ironically, if I understand things correctly, higher prices for gas in Ukraine would impact Yanukovych's base more than anybody else's. So my guess is if he were in power, he would try to renegotiate, get lower gas prices. I'm not sure what he'd offer in return. One suspects maybe being more open to talks about a single economic space. But again, I leave it to people on the panel and in the audience who know much more about this than I do. So summing up very quickly, both the United States and the European Union would clearly prefer a reconstituted orange coalition to a blue-orange one. Secondly, a new orange coalition would probably move ahead with NATO membership plans, which the U.S. ultimately would be able to push through the alliance, not the membership, but the membership action plan, which would lead to it. And thirdly, a blue-orange coalition, far less likely, would mean a course correction in international orientation, but certainly not the complete break and fleeing back to Moscow that the popular press has seemed to predict. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Let me now open the floor to questions. I'll just ask if you could identify yourself and your affiliation. Beth.
Thanks, Steve. I'm Beth Jones from APCO Worldwide. Thanks very much to some great presentations, lots of food for thought there. I wanted to pick up, Mike, on your comment at the end about energy, both from two perspectives. One from the from a question on where the center of gravity in Ukraine is on fighting corruption. The energy sector provides a good target for fighting corruption or to be corrupt. But also where any of you think or how you think Russia will react, depending on which coalition we end up with on energy matters, in particular on the gas thing. Will this provide more food for a second gas attack, or will have the Russians learn their lesson and will sort of back off and be more market-oriented?
Well, have they learned their lesson? I think they've learned a lesson, certainly. And the EU has reacted really in context, I think, rather with dispatch. I mean, they've had the Polish prime minister has been in the forefront, not surprisingly, to streamline, to get a coherent EU policy on energy. And it's obviously it's still in the talking stage, and it would take a rather sizable investment in a lot of infrastructure in order to accomplish it. And of course, their whole point is to get alternatives so they wouldn't be completely dependent on Russia. But if I were sitting in the Kremlin and I were looking at the reaction over the last 90 days, I would say Europe was clearly shocked. The EU is reacting. The reputation of the Putin administration clearly has suffered, and my guess is that there would not be a second gas attack. Now, as to exactly what they, the details, I'm gonna stop there. My guess is Mike or Henry or Steve could handle it.
Just a comment that if Tymoshenko becomes prime minister, this issue becomes front and center right away. I mean, and that's obvious. I mean, you heard what she ran on, what Henry said. Maybe she's faking it, and maybe she can be bought off. But I don't actually think. I think on this one, she's going to fight. And after all, it's not about, we don't know who owns this company, for God's sakes. It's ridiculous. It is totally ridiculous situation. Moreover, in terms of, the fact that Gazprom would acquiesce to this company being the intermediary, A, that's not market. That doesn't make any market sense if you're Gazprom. So if you're a shareholder in Gazprom, you look at this and say, this is politics. But B, it's not. It's corruption. It's outrageous corruption. And then C, if I'm a Russian taxpayer, you know, this company's registered in Switzerland, right? So it's not being taxed by the Russian government. The money's going elsewhere to other people. And so, I mean, I'm just actually verbatim almost saying back to you the way Tymoshenko talks about it. So that is a scenario that the folks who are involved in this deal, both Ukrainians, Russians, and probably Israelis, they don't want to see her as prime minister, because I think she will try to open it up. And more generally, I think one of the other things that we haven't mentioned, I mean, there was a lot of, you know, throw out the bandits was not something she ran on. That was a phrase from the Orange Revolution. And what's striking to me, looking at what's happened comparatively there, is that there hasn't been a structure set up to deal with these legacies, with corruption, with Gangadze, with, you know, falsification of the elections. I mean, there was no penalty for what they did in 2004. Now, I know that, you know, to go back in lustration and putting everybody in jail, or, you know, real revolutionaries shoot the bad guys from, you know, from the Ancien regime. Thankfully, they're not doing that. That, I think, is really good. And I think, as you know, South Africa showed, and Chile and other places, you do have to compromise in order to move forward. But what's striking about Ukraine is how unstructured the compromise is, that it hasn't been codified. And that actually worries me. You know, you need a commission, you need a reconciliation, you need an amnesty where the rules of the game are kind of set up. And that, I think, you know, is a potential for real volatility moving forward. That's the first thing. One of the things that I would like to see them set up.
I might just add one other comment. And I say this from the context of somebody who in January was saying, well, maybe this deal is not so bad, because as long as Ras Ukrenergo is on the Russian side of the Ukrainian-Russian border, and you're in Ukraine, you can say that's a Russian problem. But some of the agreements that apparently were struck as side agreements do bring Ras Ukrenergo fully into the Ukrainian market. The only caution I would have, if Tymoshenko ends up in a position where she can influence this, is that the Ukrainian side, I think, would have to be careful about how it undoes the agreement. Because the sympathy that Ukraine found from Europe and more generally in the West on January 2nd, January 3rd, was not because people in the West felt that Ukraine should continue to get gas at $50 per thousand cubic meters. It was sympathy because of the brutal way in which the Russians had approached the problem by turning the gas off in the middle of January. And so if Ukraine causes the deal to come undone and it's seen as Ukraine's fault, Ukraine may not be able to count on the sort of support and sympathy and empathy it had in the West in January. So just a caution.
Leonard Oberlander with People to People International. And what I'm asking is my own personal view, and not representing People to People on this. I'd like to telescope out a little bit from the issue just discussed. The American assistance and government assistance to Ukraine with regard to the elections was very transparent and out front and easily understood. However, in truly democratic fashion also, businesses in Ukraine and business clans that were both Ukrainian and regional participated, had activities with regard to the elections in support of the various parties and candidates. Also, American heavy hitter law firms, PR firms, strategic firms also participated in the election. They were hired in democratic fashion to participate by some of the business interests there. And a lot of this was under the radar, and there are client-attorney relationships and so forth. What can you say about the saliency to the elections of the activities of these business and business clans and the assistance received from the United States, from the private sector? And what do you think will be the saliency to the post-election government and to its foreign policies?
First of First, I just finished a massive study of the role of the United States in the Orange Revolution. So once it's approved by AID for public consumption, I'll be happy to send it to you. Okay? And the bottom line I would say on that and in this current election is that there was no U.S. – just to be clear, there was no U.S. government money that went to any political party. And there just wasn't. There was a lot of private money, international private money, that went to everybody. And most of it came from Russia, by the way, not the West. But it did come from the West. First point. Second point, as you pointed out, there was a lot of consultants, Russian, American, Canadian, that played a role in the Orange Revolution and in this election. And I think that's important because there was a lot of that, and then therefore, you know, Ukraine as a government and as a democracy has to decide its rules about what is legitimate and illegitimate. To me, they have to have a new campaign electoral law that says you can do this, you can't do that, right? But I think it's important to point out some of the myths of the Orange Revolution. There was a ton of press presented about Pavlovsky and Nikonov and Markov, these Russian public relations, quote unquote, specialists. You know, they didn't do such a good job, in my opinion. But you know, they were hired guns, and we made a lot of the fact that they were hired guns from Russia. But that they were just hired guns. And now this time it's Manafort, you know, working for Yanukovych, and it's Aristotle International working for Mr. Medvedchuk, also didn't do such a great job. But that to me is market stuff. That has nothing to do with, like, geopolitics. That's just people hired their services, you know, and if the government allows that to happen, and many countries do, then I think we should treat it that way and not as a kind of geopolitical football, because it's very striking. You know, there was a lot more American consultants working for the blue team this time than the orange team.
Yeah, I'll just briefly add. I mean, I think that's one of the differences between this election and the previous elections under Kuchma is that. Because I think partly because of the division of power, shift away from the presidency and the entrance of a new president who is either less able or less willing to use the really kind of the strong administrative resources, machine politics methods, it was much more possible for businesses of all stripes in Ukraine to choose sides one way or the other in terms of who they were going to support. In the past, it was very risky to support an opposition candidate, and so there were only a few, for example, during the Orange Revolution within Ukraine that would really kind of come out strongly and support Yushchenko. And actually, just an addendum to what Mike said, I think also there was Russian money or at least some kind of support supporting Yushchenko a little bit too in the Orange Revolution because, you know, Russian business also is not unified in its interests. So I think in that sense, because there was just much more freedom for business to support different candidates, the different parties had a lot greater access to financial resources no matter what their ideological stripes were, what their stance was towards the government. And so in that sense, I think perhaps the outside money was perhaps less decisive or less necessary in this particular case.
And just a footnote, there were Russian consultants working for Our Ukraine 2 years ago, too. They're just a little more discreet about their work than some of the other folks.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Maciej Pisarski, Polish Embassy. Let me start with a very short comment. Last week, I listened to Dr. McFaul's comments on the elections in Belarus on NPR. Very good show. And when I compare it to today's presentation, you know, the difference is striking. And, you know, one cannot escape an impression that those two countries are on a different planet today. But my question is, well, it's a whole universe. my question, though, is that I'd like to ask the panel, what do you think the consequences will be for the presidency of the President Yushchenko if he decides to form a coalition with the party of the regions of Ukraine? I mean, both domestically and internally. Thank you very much.
Not to support these regions. They said the regions are Kuchma 3, and they are very, you know, they are very strong about it. and perhaps because they don't want to get marginalized in this coalition, and they were extremely alienating towards regions.
And I think also, as I mentioned, the political council of our Ukraine has also expressed support for a restoration of the Orange Revolution. That happened this morning as well. So I think the big question, though, is we still have to see, though, the talks being finalized between President Yushchenko and Ms. Tymoshenko.
I mean, in answer to your question, I think it would be the end of Yushchenko. His political career would be over, right? I mean, think of the scenario. Tymoshenko then assumes the mantle of the Orange Revolution. She gets to be speaker with no, or she gets to be the lead of the opposition with no responsibility. And in a polarized electoral outcome again, if you can recreate it, it's 52-44, right? I mean, I think she is, and then add to that the marginal but significant gains that she's made in other places. That that's something new. So I think she becomes the heir apparent. It would be hers to lose in terms of the presidency. My other sense. I mean, I when I saw several people in the Our Ukraine coalition and Tymoshenko on my last trip there about 3 weeks ago, I'll be honest. I think it would be bad for Ukraine. My own view is that it would be bad for an orange-blue coalition. And Anders and I have had this debate publicly, sometimes privately, with a little more heat. What I'm suspicious of with the folks out east is the following. And let me start with the good news first. Yes, they're not pro-Russian. That's all a bunch of BS, and it was 2 years ago, with all due respect. They're not pro-Russian. The Russians would eat them alive if Russia were in charge of the government in Kiev. I mean, they're not pro-Russian, first. Second, they've flipped, of course, in their public relations. Mr. Akhmetov, by the way, Yanukovych is not an important political figure in my view. It's Mr. Akhmetov that controls the party now. He has a very aggressive PR campaign, reaching out to the West, inviting friends out to look at my palace and have dinner with me. I'm not a bad guy. I'm just like you. I mean, that's their orientation. And so in that regard, that's a positive thing. And therefore, this is not, the communists versus the marketeers. It's not that. But here's the big but. The big but is that I haven't seen anything. Maybe I'm wrong, and there's lots of people here that know Ukraine better than I. I haven't actually seen anything from Mr. Akhmetov or any of his colleagues, frankly, that said, we were wrong during the Orange Revolution. It was wrong to try to falsify those elections, and the Ukrainian people spoke with their ballots and then with their feet. And we're now part of this new democratic, transparent, competitive enterprise that is the new Ukraine. If they would say that, then I would change my views. But what I fear is a coalition that brings those guys in, you get the return of corrupt politics, corrupt business deals, using the power of the state for economic gain. And that, I think, is a chapter of Ukraine's past, not part of its future. So if I'm willing to, believe people that say they've changed their ways, but, show me a little evidence that they have transformed. And by the way, I say this as somebody who was really burned talking about communists 15 years ago, saying, oh, now they've joined the market and now they're going to do politics just like, they're going to be, they want market-oriented companies. Actually, turned out, they wanted a different kind of company, a closed company, all the money to them, no transparency, who owns the company, you don't like minority shareholders, so you don't give them a visa, you try to push them out of your company. That's what, so why are these guys any different? What have they done to demonstrate that they're on this other path? Sorry for the long, but you gave me the opportunity.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree completely with Mike said. I would just say that I think the Party of Regions would eat them alive. I mean, I just don't. They got more votes. They're tougher. They. I just think it would be a suicide course for that reason alone. But I don't think it's going to happen.
I would just add, I think that from the point of view of Ukraine's foreign policy, although the president still retains the prime responsibility for making foreign policy, he'll appoint the foreign minister and the defense minister. Having that orange-blue coalition, I think, really complicates Ukraine's Euro-Atlantic course, because so much of what you have to do now in terms of drawing closer, ultimately joining NATO, the European Union, it's not foreign policy. It's domestic policy. It's economics. It's your Ministry of Justice. And all those ministries are going to be controlled by the prime minister. So I think it's wishful thinking to assume that you could have an orange-blue coalition and still maintain the focus that President Yushchenko laid out in January of 2005 in terms of Ukraine's course.
Small little data point, just to Renaissance Capital had a big investment conference in Kyiv about a month ago. 500 people came, explosive, as they proudly announced there's $5 trillion represented in the room here. I don't know where they came up with that figure, but this is the biggest show of foreign capital ever in the history of Ukraine. And every major company in Ukraine came up and gave what I thought were really encouraging. Interpipe, I mean, everybody gave what I thought were really professional presentations to try to attract investment, both direct investment and portfolio investment. The one company that wasn't there was Renat Akhmetov's company.
Nadia McConnell, U.S.-Ukraine Foundation. I'd like to return to the question and answer about the influence of these hired guns, these PR mercenaries that tried to play a role in this campaign. Yanukovych is the big loser because despite some very high price and a lot of money that was spent because of these consultants, and not only, of course, American consultants, but the Russian consultants, I think the real winner is the Ukrainian voter because they were able to see through. They certainly didn't fall for some of the PR gimmicks. They didn't fall for the idea of celebrities becoming heads of parties, et cetera. But what we are seeing, though, and based on some of the comments today, this morning, is that maybe, unfortunately, some of our U.S. policymakers are not quite as discerning and perhaps are falling susceptible to some of this PR remaking of Mr. Yanukovych. We saw that in the Wall Street Journal article last week. And I find it very disturbing hearing some of the comments that are being attributed to some of U.S. Officials. Of course we will work with whatever government is in Ukraine. That's a given. We do that in a lot of countries. We can't play favorites. So, of course, that's the stated policy. We also understand that. But moving from that to somehow forgetting what Mr. Yanukovych represents and somehow saying, well, now he's somebody we could really, really work with, that's a step too far. And I have to say that last week we were getting information from Ukraine that some U.S. officials were pushing this idea of an orange and blue revolution. And I find that disturbing because it's one thing to say we will work with whoever, but it's another to sort of maybe be putting out this idea that, you know, maybe it wouldn't be such a bad thing to bring all the regions together.
Well, I that's news to me. I don't have any information about that. I would really be interested in details. I certainly didn't mean to imply that there was jubilation in the State Department and the Pentagon that there might be a blue-orange coalition. No way. Look, yes, we do try to work with most governments, but there's some governments that we don't try to work with. And I mean, I don't think this is going to happen. I think we're talking about a hypothetical situation that I think it's a counterfactual one. But I don't get any sense whatsoever from the people I speak with, at least, and I probably am the last person in this room to defend the Bush administration. I don't get any sense that there's a reevaluation of Yanukovych. Maybe I'm missing something. I don't know what my colleagues feel.
As a former U.S. government official, I would make two comments. One, I think Mike's exactly right. I haven't heard those suggestions. I mean, it is a natural thing for the U.S. government to say that it will work with whatever government emerges from the result of a democratic process in Ukraine. I mean, you really can't say anything else. I've not heard any suggestions, Nadia, that you'd heard from Ukraine last week, and I would be frankly surprised. And I do recall a number of instances when I was in government when there were rumors about U.S. positions that bore little relation to reality. I guess the one factoid I would point out is when you look at when Secretary Rice, in addition to her comments yesterday, when Secretary Rice went to Ukraine in December, she had, by the information I saw, just one meeting with somebody outside of government, and that was Yulia Tymoshenko.
I mean, cut me off whenever you want. But I think the confusion here, I heard similar things when I was in Ukraine just a few weeks ago. I heard some opposition orange folks say that Ambassador Herbst has not been useful to us. And my response to that is that Ambassador Herbst's job is not to get you elected. That is, I think there's a confusion about what diplomats do, and I'm sitting next to one who served in that job and lived in that house. And, his job, and I would say the folks out there, is to have contact with everybody. I think it would be actually, frankly, irresponsible if he didn't. Here in Washington, at higher levels, and I mean senior levels, where I've been in discussions, both of government people who are serving in government and people who are elected to government, I haven't heard anybody say that they think it would be a good idea to bring these people back, despite the tremendous efforts from those folks out, the people you're talking about, to change the views. Right? It's one thing to get a favorable piece in the Wall Street Journal. I have my own piece in the Wall Street Journal today in the European edition, which says the opposite of what Fred said, by the way. That's one thing. But to interpret that as U.S. policy, I think, is wrong. And I think that often happens out there. And with all due respect, it's because people in Ukraine think that the outcome of this election is something that's important to the United States. Let's be honest. George W. Bush is not thinking about whether Yanukovych or Akhmetov is going to be in the next Ukrainian government. He's got many other things to think about. And therefore, our stakes in trying to manipulate or, behind the scenes, who's going to be in the next government, I just think that's not it's not the role of our government today. It is our role when, in the Orange Revolution, when there are really egregious things happen. But B, even if we had a preference for that, I think there are other things that are dominating what official Washington, I like that phrase that Mike's been using, what official Washington is thinking about these days.
I think that it's striking, as I said at the very outset of my little presentation, the uncertainties. I mean, you compare what we've been saying for the last hour and a half about likely outcomes domestically or in foreign policy with the predictions of what would happen if there were a change in Germany from Schröder to Merkel and when it happened. I mean, in the foreign policy realm, within a day or two, everybody was pretty clear what was going to happen and what would not happen. And I would submit it's more or less the same thing with the Berlusconi, Prodi, if that happens. So I think the idea that people are making these great contingency plans is normal. I mean, if the more uncertain the situation is, the more you have to have contingency plans. But I think Mike McFaul is exactly right. You shouldn't confuse normal contingency planning and normal diplomacy with advocacy. I just don't see that.
Hello, Andy Behoon, formerly of the Commerce Department, now with a new firm called Global Trade Development. I'd like to ask what your views might be in the formulation of, let's say, beyond the coalition, and let's assume it'll be the Orange Coalition, but the formulation of the government. Is there going to be a tendency to distribute the portfolios along more of what the Ukrainians call a professional or competency level, as opposed to a political division to the members or selected members of the members of that new coalition? What would be the tendency, as opposed to what it was, let's say, a year ago?
Well, let me ask Henry and Mike to take that on. And maybe also talk a little bit, because I heard, I think, two different views about where Ms. Tymoshenko might end up. So comment on whether she's bound for the prime ministership or speakership if there is an Orange Coalition.
It's a good question, and again, completely hard to predict in advance. But I mean, my sense is that probably the first cut is going to be by party. Basically, the coalition is going to have to involve a certain distribution of seats for each party that each party is going to have to be satisfied with. But then, probably beyond that, it depends on who has strong people for particular posts. So I would imagine, for example, that the Socialist Party, as part of this, would want to keep Lutsenko in the Interior Ministry, that sort of thing. So that's at least in general how I would expect it to go. So kind of a combination of those things, but primarily political. And then what was the second
question? Timoshenko, Prime Minister or Speaker?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think she clearly wants the prime ministership. And I mean, it's hard for me to see her agreeing to any coalition without it. Because for her, I think, you know, she's in pretty good shape politically to go into opposition. And so she's in a strong position, I think, to really insist on the prime ministership or nothing. And so it's hard for me to see her compromising and accepting the chair of the parliament. But then again, if the chair of the parliament, you know, perhaps that could be turned into a particularly powerful post if you can threaten to disband, you know, threaten to bring down the government through various machinations, every so often. But my guess is that she'll, you know, again, just purely a guess, I think she'll insist on the prime ministership. And then it's up to Yushchenko whether she gets it.
Just briefly, about a month ago there, well, several months ago, but still a month ago, it was alive, the idea that between the socialist Our Ukraine and the Yulia Tymoshenko's bloc, that they would agree beforehand that whoever came in first place gets to be prime minister and whoever comes in second place gets to be speaker. When I was talking to Tymoshenko last, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, she was in second place at the time, and she was still pushing very hard for this deal before the election. And the reason why, it's not because she's a good person, it's, you know, she's a politician, and the reason why that they're, and she, no, that came out wrong. That was awful.
What he meant to say was.
What I meant to say, it was for pragmatic purposes, not, and perhaps a genuine other higher things, which is to say that if you look, their data showed, and Besmertny confirmed this from their side too, that undecided voter that Henry was talking about, they were disillusioned Our Ukraine voters, and that their data showed that if there was some statement of the coalition before the election, then those voters would come out and vote for the coalition. Again, it didn't happen. And it was Our Ukraine that stopped it, by the way. It was not Tymoshenko was ready to go along with it. Therefore, against that backdrop, I agree with Henry. I mean, I think in terms of legitimacy and you know, who has the right to be the next prime minister candidate, I think Tymoshenko most certainly is in the driver's seat here. That would be my prediction. The other scenario, I think, is when if there's an orange-blue coalition. That's what I was getting at. In terms of your excellent question, I don't have a good answer. I think there are a couple of really key people. You know, the Minister of the Economy, everybody wants to see return to the government. Yakunurov just recently, everybody said, had to be there. Now I would put a question mark given how poorly they performed to keep him in some capacity. I don't mean prime minister. And the other last thing I would say is Tymoshenko's bench is not very deep in terms of people you can imagine as ministers. And that, I think, is a bit of the tragedy of the Para Reform and Order folks. Had they been in her, you know, there was a chance that they would have been all together. You would have had a lot deeper people to choose from. Now what do you do with those folks who, you know, at the end of the day, it's democratic politics. You go in and you don't, you know, you get whatever, 1.5%, 2 percentage points. What right do you have to come back to the negotiation table and say, well, I should be a minister? And that, I think, was a big miscalculation on the part of several of those soon-to-be former MPs.
Could I just pursue that thing? What is the likelihood that not from, let's say, Pora-PRP, but the likelihood from the Orange Coalition, let's say Tymoshenko, et cetera, and Yushchenko, actually drawing and pulling out some of that talent that is in Pora-PRP, maybe even the Kostenko Plus area, to bring into the government? In spite of the fact that they obviously didn't make the barrier.
You know, if I were in the Yulia Tymoshenko bloc and I was just traveling around 5.5 days, 6 days, 7 day weeks campaigning on behalf of the bloc, and then she came to me and, you know, in the name of competent government, I'm going to go to one of these losers. I would be rather pissed off. That's not democratic politics. I mean, that's just the fact. You know, they made a choice. They had the opportunity to be on her list. They did have the opportunity. They made a choice, and, you know, choices have consequences.
Ron McNamara with the Helsinki Commission. I just returned as one of the international observers last night and just wanted to share an observation, subtle or perhaps not so subtle, and that is that the OSCE in its evaluation of the elections termed the elections as free and fair, something that has not been part of the lexicon of OSCE observations. In fact, I can't remember the last time that they had an unqualified free and fair calculation on an election in the former Soviet space. And clearly, these were the cleanest elections in the OSCE context. And this is all against the backdrop of a lot of efforts by Belarus and together with the Russian Federation and some of the Central Asian countries to really attack the OSCE and ODIHR's domestic elections observations and the pro-democracy activities of the OSCE. Certainly Russia, and I think this has been a stinging thing for Putin, that none of the elections under his leadership have been unqualifiedly given the seal of approval by OSCE. So one of the implications that I see beyond Ukraine's borders is an intensification of this assault by Russia and Belarus and others against the pro-democracy activities of OSCE. So just wanted to get that thought out there, too.
So, yes, Rico Deli, Ukrainian Service of Radio Free Upraya Liberty. Roman Besmertny, the campaign manager for Our Ukraine, several weeks ago paraphrased the famous Soviet slogan. He said that when we say Our Ukraine, we mean Yushchenko. When we say Yushchenko, we mean Our Ukraine. I guess the logical implication of that is now that when we say Yushchenko, we mean 14%. And my question to you is, do you think that Mr. Yushchenko in the future, in the near future, is going to turn into a lame duck president in the next few years? Do you see the gas princess turning him into a British queen if she becomes prime minister? Because some people see her as a fox coming into the chicken house and going after everyone. Especially given the constitutional changes. And the second question, Yulia Tymoshenko said during the on the campaign trail that once she becomes prime minister, her first foreign visits would be to Turkmenistan and Iran. Where would you recommend her to go first? Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know how to answer the second question, but... I think that there's just a lot unresolved. I mean, the constitutional reform was done in haste. And in fact, I mean, even before the elections and even before Yushchenko knew how he was going to fare in the current elections, he was talking about the need to hold a new referendum, which would open and possibly changes in that constitutional deal that was set up to weaken the presidency to some degree. So plus the division of powers, it's not quite clear how it's going to react. I mean, on one hand, I mean, you can have a division of powers that functions very well when you have a good system of checks and balances. On the other hand, you can have disasters such as occurred in Russia in 1993, where you had a very unclear division of powers between Congress and the president. My guess is that you're going to see a struggle. The Yushchenko forces have certainly had a defeat in the battlefield, but a lot of his allies are also certainly not people who give up easily in the political struggle, especially some of the business people whose interests are at stake, and I think they have something to try and defend. And again, they were a lot of the people who really took some serious risks backing Yushchenko in the Orange Revolution. So I guess what I would expect is I wouldn't expect him just to sit back and be completely powerless. But I think that the presidency still has a large. It still has a significant amount of influence potentially. I mean, there are lots of levers, informal and formal, that could be used. And so my guess is that you're going to see a significant struggle. And then a lot of it just depends on what events happen in Ukraine. I mean, fortunes can turn very easily, and the prime minister ultimately can be removed, more easily than the president, I think, in this particular case. So, I think he's going to face a real uphill struggle in the next presidential election. But I don't know if I'd write him off as a lame duck yet.
I guess I have a different view. I think he is a lame duck president, and I think for a couple of reasons. One, he made a strategic mistake to allow that slogan that you quoted from Besmertny to be part of the campaign. There was a debate within Our Ukraine about Yushchenko's role, and the other folks said, "You're the president. You're above this. You're the symbol of the Orange Revolution. You shouldn't be part of this. And what they did is they kind of cut the difference in between with the worst possible outcome, right? That is, he didn't really campaign, right? He didn't really go out there. And yet that slogan was part of it. So he was tainted with this 14%. And, you know, to me, that was really just bad campaign advice. Maybe they need an American there. And I know, I mean, no, that was just, you know, for his political interests, I think that was the worst of all possibilities to be in that in-between position. Moreover, let's be honest. I mean, he hasn't proven himself to be a user of that office in an effective way in the last year and a half. I don't see any reason now, especially if Timoshenko comes roaring back after having been fired by him, wins this election, and then comes back with you know, the energy that she brings to that office. It's hard for me to see how he regenerates the presidential office. Now, let's remember, there's a lot of ambiguity about the constitutional deal. And before the election, a lot of debate about maybe we should pull that back. And, you know, frankly, those that wanted to had a window of opportunity to do that before the election. After the election, it's going to be nearly impossible to do that, to say, hey, wait a minute, we want to have more powers to the president. So that was another big opportunity they missed. In terms of where she should go, I think it's exactly right. You know, what's the number one economic issue for Ukraine? It is securing alternative sources of gas. And at the end of the day, you look around the world and you look around the possibilities for Ukraine. You know, Iran and Turkmenistan have to be part of that equation. So I think that's a very pragmatic thing. And our official Washington, Mike, when you see them, tell them to mellow out and not overreact. This is exactly what we want a pragmatic prime minister to do. And that leads me to the last thing about if indeed Timoshenko is prime minister. You know, the spin I get from her and her folks is that, you know, you guys overreacted to nationalization talk. You know, what did that really come to? That meant, you know, I produced more foreign investment in Ukraine than ever before in the year 2005. Nobody, that was never a headline. And, you know, $5.5 billion, significant direct foreign investment. But the second thing they say is, you know, we learned that we made mistakes. And that, you know, that to me is the big question mark. Did they really learn? Will you have a different prime minister in terms of the way she does the job? I mean, I want to be optimistic, and I believe that people can learn. But that to me is the question. Because otherwise you're going to be in the volatile electoral cycle that I talked about. And our Ukraine people were already talking 4 months ago about having new elections, dissolving the parliaments, which the president can do. You know, he can be involved in that, and having new elections in the fall, which to me is the worst outcome imaginable.
Dick Murphy, CSIS. Just a quick panel or question to anybody on the panel. Would you care to speculate on the prospects for judicial reform, particularly the appointment of a constitutional court in a new government?
It's a tough one. Yeah. So. Yeah.
Steve, yeah. I think recognized need for that to happen. I'm not sure I'd say I expect it to be at the top of the list after the new government gets established, although it needs to be up on that list fairly quickly.
Thank you. I'm Andrea Vessa with ABA Sealy. My question is also along legal lines. I have to get back to you after checking with our office in Ukraine on that. We're working hard on it. But my question has to do with the role of the lawyers. And I actually asked this question of the Ukrainian ambassador to the U.S. a couple weeks ago at Radio Free Europe. And the idea was to do public education with the voters and have them understand their rights and what happens if they don't get on voter lists and what happens if their vote isn't counted and how can they appeal and so on. And the way that he answered the question to me is, yes, of course, judicial independence is very important, and also certain parties have appointed lawyers to work pro bono and teach people about their voting rights. Like, I see some issues with that, skewing their vote and so on. And I was wondering, especially if Henry can answer this, if you did see a visible presence of the lawyers at the voting polls and helping people out. Was it a positive experience and so on? I don't know if...
I was actually not there for the actual voting, so you know, I was there for the campaign about a week beforehand. So maybe one of the observers, if there's someone here, could, yeah, I guess he left. So,
just a quick comment on this. I think this is one of the other really good news stories. ABA Sealy is involved. The level of attention to voter rights, this NIO coalition that the U.S.-Ukrainian Foundation has put together, they were all just as active, the CVU, they were all just as active this election as they were before. I think they were trying to go beyond that, and I applaud them, and I think down the road this has to be a focus to say, you know, we need elections based on issues and information about the candidate. One of the bad things about this new electoral system, of course, is that it's a party list. There's no constituents anymore, and so there's very little discussion of who else is on the list after the top the figures. And you know, the NIO folks were trying to put that information together, but a lot more needs to be done on that. But I think the real good news is what Mike said, or the Electoral Observer who left said. I mean, this was truly a qualitatively different kind of election than you've had in the region before, and particularly the fact that the turnout rate in the East in particular were so low, I took that as a positive sign. That means that ballots weren't being stuffed, and frankly, I expected a different outcome in the East. I expected turnouts to be astronomical, and they weren't. So I'm pleasantly and surprised by that.
Well, I think we've exhausted our time. We have covered a lot of ground. In my introductory comments, I observed that on Sunday, as I was watching the election, I found it somewhat boring. But I think as we've seen today, Ukrainian politics remains very far from boring. And for the very interesting discussion today, please join me in thanking our panelists. I think it was a very good talk.